nightingale sings her fairy tale, and I am once again with you, though I dream in vain. In my heart there will remain my stardust melody, a memory of love's refrain, because my prayer day is a dream that's divine. My prayer is a rapture in blue, in a world far away, just as long as I'm with you.
This is J.D. Doyle, and welcome to Queer Music Heritage. I took that piece, including Stardust and My Prayer, out of a longer medley from a 1965 album called Gazzaris Presents Troy Walker. And Troy Walker is the subject of my special feature interview this month. One thing that makes it special is that I love to share with you the actual voices of our pioneers, and this one started recording about 50 years ago, and he's still performing. Now, he never became a household name, but he's done a lot of music and worked with many people you do know, like Jerry Lee Lewis, Leon Russell, Timmy Euro, and has stories to tell about Johnny Ray, Cher, Phil Spector, among others. And he never compromised, in that he was a very flamboyant performer, and he did not tone down his style. L.A. in those years was a very cutthroat town, and Troy just tried to make his music amidst all that. And he was a quite popular performer up into the 80s, when he stepped back from the business for a while. I first played his music on one of my shows in 2004, and since then had been wishing I could track him down for an interview. That finally happened when I found mention of a recent performance and a person to actually ask for contact information. That turned out to be Johnny Whiteside, who happens to be the author of an excellent biography on Johnny Ray. He got me in touch with Troy, and I started the interview by asking him for a little about his growing up.
I grew up in Illinois, first part of my life. Then we moved to Arizona, and I went to school there, pretty much high school.
And what landed you in Los Angeles?
Well, I went into the Air Force, and when I got out of the Air Force, I just wanted to come over here and decide what the hell my life was all about. So I came over to Hollywood and walked into a bar. And the guy asked me if I could sing. I told him I sang in high school. He shoved me a mic. I sang two songs, and the owner came over and asked me to come in every night and sing. And I was underage. But I came in anyway and wound up singing ever since.
Who would you say your musical influences were?
Mine? Oh, wow. Well, the Platters, Jackie Wilson, Little Richard, a lot of the black groups when I was a kid. They weren't popular, but they were with me. We used to go in the alley and listen to them.
And when did you start going by Troy?
About the same time. I grabbed the name whenever I first hit Hollywood.
Can you describe your stage act back then?
Back then? Well, it was never really an act. I just got up and sang, and I started regular singing, and thank goodness that was bought for the most part. When I got on stage, actually, started getting, you know, I get whistled at, and because it wasn't my fault. I was, lack of a better way to put it, a little pretty boy. And so I'd get whistled at, and they'd sound off with some names and so forth, and I'd come back with some smart-ass remark.
So you were good at handling hecklers?
Yeah, I became good at it. I can't say I was good at it. I just always, I seemed to always have the audience on my side, you know. I played off of that. I get paid to be a jackass. Why are you here? You know, that sort of thing.
I've gotten the impression that your act was kind of a cross between Johnny Ray, Frankie Lane, Jackie Wilson, and Don Rickles.
I guess, yeah. Kind of, you know. To say that it was an act, I always kind of wondered about that, because it's not something that I, you know, polished or perfected. It's just what I did. I happened to have this range voice that I could do other voices, and then getting a little clever, you know.
I understand you became really good at doing impressions, like Diana Ross, Johnny Mathis, Roy Orbison, Elvis, etc.
Yeah. To say that I was an impressionist, I don't think it's all that accurate, because what I did was I would take the hit song and affect the voice, and it would be just enough to make it work. It worked for me, you know. Dinah sang through her nose, you know. Johnny sang through the side of his mouth, and I watched them and I met them and sort of picked up on it. I've never really thought that was all that great a thing, you know. Other people did, but I didn't. I just kind of wove it into an act, because I would do just a remember when, and I would go back and I would throw out Dinah's voice or Della Reese, you know, that sort of thing. Making up kind of a little story.
Mm-hmm.
You'll hear an example of how he could imitate other voices when he describes this next recording.
I understand you have a bunch of 45s. I found a 45. I'm not sure it's you, though. It's called She's All Right and I'm Getting Hip.
I'll be damned. Yes, that's me.
It is? That's you?
That's me.
It doesn't sound quite like your other stuff.
No, it wouldn't sound like I. That was a pretty bull arrangement. It kind of sounded like a Jackie Wilson tune, right?
Right, right. Yeah. But I knew you're famous for doing all kind of different voices, so I figured, well, maybe it's him.
That one was brought to me by one of Elvis's people. It was a good song. I recorded that, and the other side is... you reminded me, and I even forgot what the other side is. She's All Right, and I'm Getting Hip. Yeah, I wrote I'm Getting Hip. Yeah, again, that was something we were sitting in, and we threw together. They played it locally. I know that it was played. It was one of those things that you call in and you vote on it.
Right.
I think I won that thing, and then they played it for another week or something. I'm not really sure.
Billboard mentioned it in 1961.
61?
Yeah.
Whoa. That is way back there.
In March of 61, they wrote a review. Troy Walker turns in a swinging vocal on a bright hunk of material.
I'll be darned.
March 61.
That's the first I knew that it got written up. I didn't pay too much attention, as you see.
And here's a bit of both sides of that 1961 single, She's All Right and I'm Getting Hip. I switch songs at the sax break.
You played a lot of clubs, and some of these were long engagements, like for many months.
Oh, yeah. I would do one-nighters, and I would go for months on years, and a couple of them I would be there on two nights a week, you know, one night a week. But I was moving around all different clubs. I did that for years.
I'm so hurt to think that you lied to me.
For those of you who need a reminder, or those too young to know, that was a little bit of the song Hurt from 1961, the biggest hit of an artist with a soaring voice, Timmy Euro. And that sets the stage for my next question.
I've read a number of places about your professional involvement with Timmy Euro and different accounts of why that didn't work. Can you fill me in on that?
I met Timmy, she came into where I was working in the valley, and from clear across the room, we started singing to each other. And we wound up a duet, we went to Vegas, played Vegas, and then they wanted a singer to do Dinah Washington's Hurt, her song, and they wanted a singer that sounded black. And so... We were playing in Vegas, and they flew Timmy back here, and she cut Hurt, and I didn't know anything about it. And I came back into town, and suddenly there was a hit record playing on the radio. It's quite a story. It goes on to different things that happened, but we were signed with Liberty Records.
But you didn't record for Liberty.
I guess we did. We recorded, but they didn't do anything with it.
Right. They didn't release anything.
No.
Well, I would have loved to have heard a duet with you two.
It was something to hear. I'm sure there's tapes somewhere,
yeah.
But I wouldn't know where, you know, because they did record us. They recorded several things with us, but nothing ever came of it. Just suddenly, Clive Davis came in and got Timmy. I was just gone. They offered me some tunes that I just wasn't interested in, and I didn't know that there was a planned separation, and that would all came as a surprise. Not a heartbreak I was glad for, you know, but it was a surprise.
A couple articles I've seen suggested that you were maybe too flamboyant for Liberty.
I'm sure I was too flamboyant for anybody at the time. I wasn't even flamboyant. I was really being just myself, and it worked for me. You know, I was small, for lack of a better way to put it, pretty face thing, and you know, I would get a lot of flack from that. It turned out to be good and bad. You know, I was no one ever made me aware that I was too much. All I got was, you know, praise and they're interested, but I was so busy working and just maintaining my status working that I didn't really deal with any of that other, you know, too much. But different people that I helped into the business went on and told me much later on that there were record companies, I guess, were scared of me. I was a little much, they thought, you know. But that was back whenever... A lot of tongue-in-cheek, you know, nobody talked about nothing, you know.
Uh-huh. One other rumor I saw was that another reason for a split with Timmy was that you were seeing her boyfriend, Joe.
Yeah, that was true. And it turned out to be really a sad situation because it did hurt Timmy. That was never an intent, but I was caught up in something that I didn't have any control over either, for that matter.
Another 45 I don't have, but I've seen it on the internet. Summertime and Midnight in Moscow.
Yeah, now that was recorded at the Interlude with Gene Norman Presents. That was his record, GNP. That was his record label.
Uh-huh.
And that was a cover. Midnight in Moscow came out, and he wanted a vocal to have sing words to it. And that's what happened. I went in and did a vocal on however Midnight in Moscow went.
Yeah, that's how I remember it. It sounded like an odd song to sing.
Yeah, it was. It was an odd song to sing. And I'm trying to remember exactly how...
Because the instrumental was a pretty good hit.
Yeah, the instrumental was a big hit, and Gene wanted to cover it, and we did a recording. And the other side was Summertime. I remember doing that, and we did an up version of Summertime, I think. Yeah, and that was just me and three other musicians, I believe it was.
It's summertime. Living is easy. Fish are jumping. Whoa. So don't you know your daddy's so rich? Your mama, she's a looker. Hush, little baby. No, don't you cry. One of these mornings, you're gonna rise up singing. Wow! You're gonna spread your wings. You're gonna fly. But till that morning, there is nothing gonna harm you, no. With your daddy and mammy standing by your side.
Summertime from 1962, and several weeks after our first interview, I came back with a follow-up question.
A few days after we talked about your recording the vocal version of Midnight in Moscow, I was able to track down a sound file of the recording and a picture of the label. I got it from a collector in Belgium, and I was surprised to find out it's an instrumental.
It could very well be, because I know we recorded it and there were words to it. I sang it. It never got really confirmed with Gene what he was going to do with that, and I never even knew anything was done with it, because he got it. So it could very well be an instrumental.
He may have figured that the words just didn't work.
Yeah, he could have, because I didn't think they worked either whenever we sang it. It was kind of funky, you know. It didn't make all that much sense.
That brings us up to Troy's first full album, which was called Troy Walker Live and was released around early 1964. From that album, here's the opening song, Sinner Man.
Sinner Man, where you gonna run to? Sinner Man, where you gonna run to? Sinner Man, tell me where you gonna run to? All on that day, I run to the sea. Won't you hide me? I run to the sea. Won't you hide me? I run to the sea. Won't you hide me? Oh, on that day, the Lord said, "Send a man to see me boiling." The Lord said, "Send a man to see me boiling." Lord said, "Send a man to see me boiling." All on that day, Lord, won't you hide me, Lord? Lord, won't you hide me? Lord, won't you hide me? Find me.
Well, Satan said, now sit a man.
It's been widely reported that after the release of the live album, your career stalled because it contained the song Happiness is a Thing Called Joe. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, it was. They sent it back. It was sent back. High Fidelity, Richard Vaughn, told me that a man singing to a man, they weren't accepting, and he was getting a lot of flack, and so that kind of, I guess, died on the vine. He said he got a lot of albums that were sent back, because at the time, it really stood out on the record. That was a big disappointment, but I didn't make a big thing of it because, again, I was working, and the promise of whatever would happen in the future, whatever happened would happen.
Was that song one that you had been performing live?
Yeah.
And how was it received in a club?
Very well. Extremely well, in fact. My audiences at the time, they were into me, and it wasn't. I didn't make a thing out of the song, or for that matter, the relationship. It just was there, and that is what is so funny is none of that was ever even discussed with me. You know, it was always just other people. As Richard Vaughn said to me at one time, he said, "You'd be amazed how many people want to know about what's going on between he and I." You know, come on, tell us about Troy, you know. And there was nothing to tell. But there was, you know, people. People like to talk. Lord, how they love to talk. You know.
It seemed like happiness. Happiness is just a little thing called Joe. Now Joe, he's got a way that makes the lilacs wanna grow. You know, little Joe, he's got a way that makes all the angels heave a sigh. When they know that little Joe is passing by. Sometimes the cabin's gloomy, the table may be a little bare. But then Joe, he'll kiss you, and it's Christmas everywhere. Your troubles fly away, your life is easy go. Does little Joe love you good? Well, that's all. That's all you need to know. You see, your happiness is just a little thing called Joe. Little Joe. Little Joe, well, that's Joey.
Thank you. Thank you.
Around 1965, Troy released his second full-length album called Gazzari's Presents Troy Walker.
Well, Gazzari's was a club, I take it.
Yeah.
And that album, do you know what year it came out?
Gee, no, I really don't. That album was done. What they did, we went to Capitol Records, and they set up a whole studio like a nightclub. and that album was recorded.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking it had to be at least 1965 because it contains, one of the medleys contains the song 1, 2, 3, which came out that year.
Yeah, I would say it was about that time or else, shortly after, because that was just another one we grabbed and threw it in because I liked it, in a medley of, it's in a medley of tunes, I believe.
Right.
And as it is a studio version of a nightclub, that explains the lack of any audience noise on the recording, which I think is a plus. Let's hear that medley I just referred to, called the Rescue Me Medley, and you tell me it doesn't remind you of Jackie Wilson.
Oh, won't somebody, somebody please hold my hand. Come on and rescue me.
What song that you've recorded seems to have been the most popular?
I don't know. I really don't know because none of them really went anywhere or did anything. I mean, the Marijuana Munchies, Dr. Demento played it in his program. It was held on for a long time. That was all over the country, but we never put it out.
Let's talk about that while we're on it. That was later. Was that like 77?
Something like that. I'm not really sure.
Okay.
There was a whole era there.
Right. But, and it was called Marijuana Munchies. Can you tell me about it?
it starts out, I got the marijuana munchies and I can't help myself. I go into the kitchen and I can eat anything on the shelf. Some burritos or tostada, it don't matter how much I eat. I never get any fatter. I got the marijuana munchies and I can't help myself. Marijuana munchies and I can't help myself. It was a funny song, really. It was, and at the end where Colonel got ribs, you know. I want a burger. Somebody get me a hamburger. It was kind of a funny thing that we did. And on the other side, I think it's not the end of my world. It's on the other side. I'm not positive. We just put it out there for almost a joke.
A novelty record.
Yeah, Demento picked it up, and I've gotten more reaction on that. Everywhere I go, they want to hear that, you know, and I didn't know it had done anything because we didn't sell any.
Did you write that song?
No, it was, well, I co-wrote it with Jay York. He was just a guy that hung around. Actually, how it happened is we were in the studio. We had a rehearsal studio and we were in there just messing around, and somebody said they were hungry, and I made a statement, you know, you got the marijuana munchies, and then he started making up words and I started making up words, and the engineer just flipped on the switch and we got a basis for it and then just put it together. It was actually, it was a joke. I was making fun of the band.
I got the marijuana munchies and I can't help.
I have a big section of you on my website. Somebody found it and wrote me asking if I had a song that you did called My Friend Is Gone. Because the person that wrote me, it was a lady, and she said that she and her husband went to see your act, and you sang that song and dedicated it to him, and they had the record, but they somehow lost it over the years, and the husband has died, so she's really sentimentally attached to that song.
Yep, that's a recording that I did do, and it's a good one. It's a real good one, in fact. A lot of people picked up on it because it was a sad song, but it kind of told it like it was, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of people could identify with it.
Yeah. My friend, you gave your life trying to understand what it means to be alive and what it means to be a man. You know, so if you're listening, I hope you understand. For all the ups and downs we had, there'll be no regrets. You almost reached the stars with your words and with your songs, but now they're all I have to remind me. My friend is gone. It's a good song, and it got an awful lot of audience response and, you know, different people wanting it. And nothing was ever done with it because the band the band and I at the time, I believe we split, and it just kind of went with the Munchies thing. I have that. I have that single myself.
Would it be possible to get a recording of that from you so I could play it on my show?
Oh, hell yes. I can mail you one. I can do it that
Wonderful.
Way.
Wonderful. Well,
my friends, you gave your life trying to understand what it means to be alive, what it means to be a man. The roads you took were long and rough, you never did arrive. The rainbow you were searching for was only in your eyes. Guess I couldn't show you what you tried so hard to see. That if you can't be true to yourself, you never can be free. You left a lot of broken hearts that now must bear the pain of a man who died in loneliness, a friend who died. Embrace you. It's hard when people say that the life that was yours to live was yours to take away. The stage seems so empty where you used to share it with me, but I can feel your presence. I can hear your heart.
That was the very rare 45 of My Friend Is Gone. There's a story I've read about that you had a run-in with Jerry Lee Lewis.
Did I ever? Yeah, he was going to be performing at the Palomino and out here. At the time, it was the top country nightclub in the country at the time. And I was asked to be his opening act, and I went to work, and he was a bit inebriated, and I guess his daughter had flirted with my guitar player. When I came in, I rounded the corner going into the back to the dressing rooms, and he had two of my people in headlocks, and my piano player's glasses were falling off, and we had quite a little I did something I probably shouldn't put on the radio, but I told him to let go of my people.
Did you pull Did you pull a gun on him?
yes, I did. He had two of my people in the headlock. You know, I had to do what I had to do. He's drunk as a skunk. And I already known that he shot people from stage, you know, and kicked pianos off on people, and he's been pretty rowdy at times. And he said, "Who in something are you?" And I said, "I'm your opening act, or I was your opening act, Mr. Lewis." And he, you know, grumbled. He had no choice but to let my people go. And he went back into his dressing room, and shortly one of his people came out and said Jerry wanted to talk to me. And I said, screw that, because he had quite a reputation for being a tough guy. And he shot some people from stage. So I was reluctant to go back, but finally did. And he called me a ballsy little so-and-so. And come to find out, his daughter comes walking in and called Jerry a few names and said, he wasn't doing anything with me. I was flirting with him. And she called Jerry names. And anyway, he apologized and told me I was going on. I said, no, I'm not, you know, because I told the boys to pack up. And he went on and introduced me. He said, I've never worked with a dude in a doily, but I want to introduce you to someone that I'm giving my name up to. And he said, here's the killer, Mr. Troy Walker. And I came out, and he, it wound up being a very beautiful thing, because I wound up opening it for him quite a bit. But it didn't start out pretty. Country, soul, and rock and roll, that's another, just reminded myself, another recording of mine where I sing about him. And he got a kick out of it. He asked me to come down to Nashville, work in a club down there. You know, I never win, but it was a good thing that happened between Jerry and I, except that I think he was quite surprised, the kid in the doily, you know, telling him to let go of my people in the way I did it.
This song you just mentioned, was this something you recorded?
Well, yes, yeah, I recorded it. It's on the other side of My Friend Is Gone, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
So I can send you that, and that was a good one. That was a real good, what do you call it, country rock. I started singing the song, standing at my daddy's knee. They said I was as cute as could be. Singing Mary Had a Little Lamb, beating on an old frying pan, watching Jerry Lee on my TV. Doing country soul and rock and roll, oh, oh, one night stand at the Hollywood Bowl. It's always been a dream, and I'll feel just like a king, doing good old country soul and rock and roll. It was a good song.
Wonderful. I can't wait to hear it.
Singing songs, standing at my daddy's knee. They said I was as cute as could be. Singing Mary Had a Little Lamb, and I was beating on an old frying pan, watching Jerry Lee on my TV. You know the times they have changed, but the people remain the same, and the only claim to fame is rock and roll. Well, keep that jukebox humming, 'cause look out, I'm still coming. Words within me, listen and plead. The country soul, rock and roll, one night stand at the Hollywood Bowl. It's always been my dream, I feel just like a king, singing good old country soul and rock and roll. Oh, yeah.
I understand you worked for a while with Leon Russell.
Oh, yeah. When I first came to Hollywood, and Leon was just bouncing around town doing different, clubs, and he played piano. My family was quite surprised. We were at Musso Frank's on Hollywood Boulevard. They came in, and my two boys and my nephew were there, and Leon walked in, and he saw me and came clear over and squatted down, and, "Where have you been? What are you doing?" And my family couldn't get their jaws up, you know. I said, "Leon, would you tell them that we did work together for several years?" It was another good moment, you know. He was an extreme talent, and I would go on stage, and I could throw anything at him, and he'd, you know, we'd cut it. In fact, I have a sneaking suspicion, we never discussed it, but I used to do Julie London, her voice, and when we were doing it, I told him, "Leon, let's kick this thing in the behind." And he did the Joe Cocker, "Now you say you're sorry," you know, and we rocked it out. And I think that's where it came from when Joe put it out. But I don't want to lay a claim to something that was strictly Leon's doing.
And I've read you read around with Cher a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Cher and I ran the streets. In fact, there's one that has a little bit of controversy involved. I recorded What Now My Love with the 21-piece orchestra. And Green and Stone, who I guess were managing Sonny and Cher at the time, came into the studio and, that kid's got some real pipes on him. And they bought, Dave Galcani, who was producing it with me, sold them the whole thing, and they just lifted my voice off of it, and Sonny and Cher did it.
Wow. Yeah, and, her version is terrific.
Yes, it is. But it was my version. The whole arrangement was mine. And it was a hell of a recording. And it came out, and they were doing a benefit at the Tiger nightclub. And I went, and Sonny and Cher were there, and I walked over to Cher, and I said, it's about your recording. I said, yeah. You know, that was my record. She didn't know. Cher didn't know that had been done. And she asked Sonny, and I guess it was a little bit of a burr flu, because she got angry that they had taken my voice off. And that's done in Hollywood, I guess, quite a bit, but I didn't know anything about it, and she didn't either. But we recorded that at Gold Star.
Since you mentioned Gold Star, did you run into Phil Spector?
So did I ever. I shouldn't. The Teddy Bears, way back, To Know Him Is to Love Him.
Yep.
Way back then, I ran into Phil Spector. I was running around with Marshall Lieb, who was one of the Teddy Bears. And, I ran into Phil Spector.
You got to tell me. You got to tell me the story.
No, I can't. There's some things that I could have raised that controversy a long time ago, but it has no place. I don't want the tag. You know what I mean?
Okay.
I just don't want the tag because it was a strange scene. But To Know Him Is to Love Him has a very unique bridge. Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
And you contributed that, and they took it.
No, I didn't contribute. They were coming up with a sound, I guess. And I suggested it, and I guess Marshall took it back in. And Phil, of course, he was busy shooting somebody. I don't know. I never cared for him very much. There's several reasons. You know, Darling Love was a dear friend, and he did a lot of people wrong. You know, for lack, that's my opinion. You know, he did a lot of good friends. Really did him wrong.
I used to say that I really admired his talent, but I wouldn't want to have lunch with him.
And not at all. I wouldn't want to even talk to him. You know, what I know and what I saw, he wasn't. I've seen him. I've seen the threats. I've seen him pull the gun. I've seen him make demands that were unreasonable. But mainly, I've seen him take great talents and
bury them.
Bury them. You use the word, sir. You use the word. Yeah, what he did with Darlene was very sad.
Yeah, I do know that story.
I have no respect.
In the 60s and 70s, did you run around with any gay entertainers?
In the 60s and 70s? No, I didn't. I really wasn't running with anybody. I was just busy 7 nights a week, every night, doing a different club somewhere.
Did you know Johnny Ray?
I met Johnny Ray. In fact, he's the only person that ever said anything to me, critiquing me, that sort of blew me away, because I went to a party. I admired Johnny. I liked the voice. And I was doing a party for him. I was playing at a party for him, and I was singing his songs, and he came out in a robe and walked around the piano looking at me, and I just kept singing. When I stopped, he says, I'm a has-been, and you're mediocre. And I fell out, you know. I mean, it sort of blew my mind. It kind of hurt my feelings, but not really, you know. What is that? But when I thought about it later on, it was kind of slam, since he had recorded with Timmy, and they couldn't even do anything with the record, and she couldn't stand him. You know, she said that it was a weak shot. But I personally always highly admired him. And when I met him, it was not disappointing, but yeah, disappointing. That's a good enough word, I guess.
I was going to comment that I saw Johnny Ray once in person, and it was in 1980. I was in L.A. on vacation. I was in a gay bar, and he was in the bar, and somebody I was talking to said, "See that guy over there? That's Johnny Ray." And he was obviously drunk.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, he was drunk whenever I met him. He was drunk, and Timmy said when they brought him in to record, I believe, with her, that he was drunk. And she said she had a terrible time recording with him.
Every time I hear a newborn baby cry, a touch of then I know why I believe.
You know, the man, what can I tell you? I guess he put more of his life out than he should have, but he was, as far as I'm concerned, he was an incredible, innovative star. It's a shame that he had to put his personal life out like he did, and he got had a lot of problems that way. But a legend is a legend, and he certainly
right.
was one, and one that I highly admired. As growing up, you asked me my influences earlier as a singer. He was one of them. In fact, the first song I did that I ever sang, period, in front of an audience was at, in the High School Follies. I did Cry, and just tore the place up, you know, doing it. I highly admired him. I did.
Talking about Johnny Ray, you said he put more of his personal life out there than he should have. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, didn't he get caught in a motel room or something or other?
Yeah, it was way back. But I remember I read it in some paper. I read that he had been caught with a Marine involved in gay performance, I guess, or homosexual performance.
Was he openly gay?
I don't know whether he was openly gay, but I mean, everybody seemed to think so. So I know there was a scandal involved with him somewhere, that he had been involved and gotten in some kind of trouble, and it really hurt his career.
As a postscript, I did some research after our talk and found that Johnny Ray had been arrested twice within a few months in Detroit for soliciting male vice cops. This was in 1951, when his career was first skyrocketing, and while still very popular, it must have hurt him with the public a little. Remember, this was 5 years before many were scandalized by the stage performances of Elvis.
Do you think you ever experienced discrimination professionally for being gay?
Oh, sure. Sure. Not overt. They wouldn't say that. But I've walked in with a husband and wife owner, and she was making comments of, you know, I'm not going to put that on our stage, and different partners. Yeah, I've had some of that, but you know, it's never, I could care less. You know, it never, you know, bothered me to the point of doing anything. But I might get a little indignant, but they'll always be that. Even with labels, you know, going to different labels, nobody knew nothing, but there was always jibber jabber talk. You know, that sort of thing went on. One time, I can't remember who the columnist was, if you're looking for a gay evening, things like that. Nothing spectacular. But if it was discrimination, it was kind of behind closed doors. They didn't come out directly at me. A couple times it did, but nothing that, you know, was earth-shaking. And one time, even Shindig, I think it was, one of those shows, the one that had Bobby Sherman. What was that show?
It was either Shindig or Hullabaloo.
Yeah, one of the two. I was in the side room, and Wink Martindale and Jimmy O'Neill and Bob Eubanks, and they were all talking, and the suggestion was that they get me for the show. You know, Troy can sing anything, blah, 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 blah. And the comment was made that I was gay and a little out there. And when I walked in the room, the person that said it, oh, Troy, we were just talking about you. How you doing? I was aware of what was said, you know, and I kind of got a little indignant there. Yeah, I know what you think, you know. And they kind of walked out of that little meeting.
Were you on those shows?
No, they were considering me for that show. I did Hullabaloo, but I did Hullabaloo at Hullabaloo in Hollywood, the big thing that they had at the old Aquarius Theater.
Did you sing on television?
Yeah, I did. I guess I did a couple times, but it was usually for benefits for Jerry's Kids, that sort of thing, you know.
Are there any questions I should ask that I haven't asked yet?
I really don't know. I don't know what I would even have to offer. Say, I don't find myself.
Well, I've been entertained for the last hour.
you sound like Johnny Whiteside. He's really a one hell of a guy, by the way. He's had a great deal to do with kind of making me want to go back. He doesn't know that, but. He really has.
Yeah, well, this has been a treat for me. I've been wanting to track you down for years, and until Johnny Whiteside mentioned on his page that you did a show. That was the first person I found that I could ask, hey, this person may know how to get a hold of you.
I'll be darned.
So otherwise, I wouldn't have had any way to connect.
This is J.D. Doyle, and I thank you for listening, and I hope you've enjoyed this very unique visit with Troy Walker. You can find out more information on my site at queermusicheritage.com, where I've compiled a lot of photos of him over the years. Down to the last song, and since I noticed Troy recorded the song No Regrets twice, I just had to ask him about it.
Is that one of your most popular songs? Because it's on both of your albums.
Yeah, it was my closing song. It's I closed with it. It was because it was done by Edith Piaf originally, and it was very inspirational because with all the heartache in her life, she did sang No Regrets, and it was sort of, you know, registered with her, and it registered very much with me and my audiences. It was a closer for a lot of the shows.
No, no regrets. No, I will have no regrets. For the grief doesn't last. It is gone. I've forgotten the past and the memory I had, I no longer desire both the good and the bad. I have thrown in a fire, and I feel in my heart that the seed has been sown. It is something quite new. It's like nothing I've known. So I'll have no, no regrets. No, I will have no regrets. For the seed that is new is the love that is growing for you. And I feel in my heart that the seed has been sown. You see, it's something quite new. It's like nothing I've known. So I'll have no, no regrets. No, I will have no regrets. For the
thank you very much.